Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker upmade me out of self-righteous hatred, and now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix, a suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they affected it. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and welcome to our annual Christmas Day installment. Even though it's not exactly Christmas Day, we felt it was most appropriate to do this show a few days prior to Christmas so that folks can have something to reflect and think about, during the weekend heading into Christmas Day, which this year is on a Tuesday, Tuesday, December 25th, 2012. And if this is going to be, as usual, another powerful show, and what makes it powerful is those folks who come on the show to contribute, you know, their views, perspectives, and their breadth of information and wisdom that they bring to various topics that we cover here at Your World News that, quite frankly, you are not going to see anywhere else on the corporate media airwaves. Yes, alternative media covers that, and we support the progressive, strong, you know, radically oriented alternative media, you know, that exists out there. And those media outlets have served as a great inspiration to the work that we do. You know, the likes of Black Agenda Report has served as a tremendous inspiration to the work that we do. And so that's an example of some of the really progressive media that we need to support, you know, because the corporate media is not supporting you. It's it is contributing to your own mental illness and obsequiousness, to a system that is based on exploitation. It contributes to your obfuscation, the confusion that many folks have, especially Americans, those that call themselves Americans, the confusion that they have around domestic issues, certainly international issues, issues of imperialism and war, and so forth. So when the corporate media and their government partners, and we should look at the corporate media as really being the fourth branch of government. If we look at them, their job is really an effective one, because their job is to program and to indoctrinate, you know, as many Americans as possible. And in this case, they indoctrinate, you know, tens and tens and tens of millions of Americans to think a certain way. So they say jump, you know, the typical American says how high. So they say invade this country because for humanitarian reasons. They say right on, let's go, let's do it. Get them, you know. Not a thought about civilian casualties and such. And so within this episode, we're going to be covering a range of things, not just breaking down and deconstructing the Christmas holiday, but we'll be deconstructing Christianity itself. Christianity itself, we'll be deconstructing that, but we'll also be delving into a range of news topics and issues, such as the tragedy that occurred in Newtown, Connecticut, and it was most definitely a tragedy and something that should be mourned. Because, you know, anytime you have you know, innocent bystanders, people, and especially children, for that matter, being slain in any shape, form, or fashion, that is a tragedy in and of itself. Children do not deserve that kind of fatal ending. That kind of they don't deserve that. And it's just, I mean, no human being does, but children, you know, being so impressionable and looking forward to living the rest of their lives, you know, and different markers in their lives that they look forward to doing, going to school and hopefully contributing to society, but all the things that children look forward to doing, and having it just ripped away from them, it is a tragedy in of itself. But we will be breaking down today and comparing and contrasting why is it that most Americans don't mourn the tragic loss of life that occurs by way of U.S. militarism, by way of U.S. imperialism. Why is that? We'll be discussing that, no holds barred. You know, those children that have perished in Pakistan by way of manless drones, those children that have perished in Libya because of the U.S. and NATO invasion, those children that have lost their lives in Yemen, Somalia, we can go on, Afghanistan, of course, Iraq. Why is it that their loss of life is not mourned in the same gravity scope as when it happens here to American children, and especially American children who are white, because we know there's you know, black children that die every single day in America by way of gun violence, and you know, sometimes it's often, you know, at the hands of police as well, You know, we look at Ayanna Stanley Jones in 2010. There was no mass mourning for that 7-year-old girl's death in Detroit, Michigan, you know, by the way of a police officer that barged into her family's home. So we're gonna take a tough look at that, and I'm happy to be joined by Your World News correspondent Peter Fowler today, who also is a frequent co-host on Your World News. He'll be joining us in one moment, and Peter brings a breadth of knowledge and perspective and insight to all these things, and definitely, you know, when it comes to Christianity and Christmas, you know, Peter being somebody who has gone through. You know, he's gone through divinity school and has, you know, read the Bible front and back and has served as a pastor himself. And we'll also be joined from the West Coast in Oakland, California, by Deacon Christopher Frazier, who will be breaking down the African science of December 25th and the winter solstice and so forth. So without further ado, I want to welcome on Peter Fowler. Peter, can you hear me?
How you doing, Solomon?
Hey, welcome on. It's an honor to be doing yet another deconstruction of Christmas and Christianity show with you this December 2012. I'm sure you heard my opening monologue, if you will, and I wanted to know, you know, what thoughts you have on those issues and any other issues, and you know, what are your opening thoughts about this holiday itself? You know,
I definitely heard your opening remarks, and I share your views and your perspective on the need to deconstruct Christmas and the need to put it in perspective and to bring some historical reality to the conversation, and also these other issues that you mentioned, some of the current issues, particularly the headline maker, the shooting in Connecticut last week, and how these things are interconnected, you know, because maybe some people are thinking, well, Christmas and the shooting in Connecticut, what's that got to do with anything? And then you mentioned Pakistan and Iraq, Afghanistan. What are all these things? What do they have to do with one another? And what are we talking about them for on Christmas? Well, they're all interconnected. So I'm right there with you, and I'm really looking forward over the next couple hours to delving into each and every one of those things and trying to expose some of the connectivity there and why talking about these things is relevant on Christmas, indeed on Christmas, at Christmas time. And let me just say this, too, that deconstructing Christmas, you know, when we do this on a regular basis, on an annual basis, because it's so important, I believe that deconstructing Christmas is vital. It's a crucial part of exposing a system that's built on deception and delusion. So it goes beyond just Christmas, but this gives us a relevant point of departure, you know, this time of year for deconstructing the various other components of what I call the big lie, you know, the great deception that is Americanism, you know. And make no mistake, we know that, you know, obviously Christmas has its roots as a Christian holiday, you know, and it still has some of the trappings of the Christian faith, and those, you know, Christians try to celebrate it in a more Christian context. But, you know, Christianity is part of that great deception. It's part of the big lie. It's part of Americanism. It is inextricable from the broader cultural phenomenon that is Americanism. And so, you know, we'll touch on that today too, and why that's important. And let's you mentioned already solstice, and you know, today is the winter solstice.
That's right.
Today is the day of the winter solstice, and you know, one of the things I want to touch on at some point after we do some deconstruction is, all right, what are we left with? You know, a lot of people don't celebrate Christmas. I don't celebrate Christmas. Things I do celebrate, things I do observe. One of those things is the solstices. There's a summer solstice and there's a winter solstice. And we ought to talk about what those, the significance of those dates, those events, what they mean, what they're about, and also look historically, because people all over the planet for, you know, back as far back as we know in human history, people observed the winter as well as the summer solstices. And many cultures also observe the spring and fall equinoxes, too. So So those are some things that are rooted in material reality, as opposed to Christmas, which is in fact rooted in mythology and in lies and in, you know, this corporate monster, you know, of consumerism that it is today. So hopefully we can touch on all of those things and more. So let's get to it, and let's talk about what Christmas is really about and what it's not about.
Right, and with that being said, I just wanted to open up by asking you a question. You know, you being somebody who has, you know, served as a pastor, you know, you went through the divinity training, you know, to be a pastor, which meant that you had to study, you know, Christianity inside and out, and few people go through that process like you did, and actually, you know, break away from it, you know, because, you know, most people stay along that trajectory and are stay within the confines that they're placed. But some reason you move to an outside lane and observe things from a different perspective. And so I wanted to ask you, why do you say? And I agree with you, but I wanted to get your not just your perspective, but your knowledge on this show. Why is Christmas rooted in what you say is mythology, where, you know, you have so many Christians that are people that would consider themselves Christians that run around on so-called Black Friday, the Friday after Thanksgiving, trampling each other to death. And so certainly they're definitely not thinking about even any of the mythological reasons, you know, about Christmas, you know, and, you know, you think of, you know, goodwill to man and so forth. And I don't see where trampling on somebody is, and seeing them being trampled on, but you're still so focused on getting that super discount on that big screen TV that you don't even notice them. I don't see that being goodwill to man. But even, you know, and within that, you know, so my point is, like, within that mythology that, you know, most so-called Christians don't even really embrace that. They don't embrace a lot of the things. You know, they accept murder and death. They've accepted it because if they rejected death and killing, they would not support their government. They would rebel against it. They would say, you know what, I serve a higher, you know, a higher authority than this government, than this man-made government, and my higher authority says that murder is wrong. Wrong is wrong is wrong. Facts are facts are facts, and so therefore, I repudiate, and because I repudiate, and the millions of folks like me repudiate death and destruction. You know, we are going to protest and demand an end to these wars as long as it takes. As long as it takes us to be in the streets. As long as it takes us to have organized, you know, organized nonviolent actions and so forth, to bring an end to this, to these wars that are killing so many innocent people overseas. If they accepted, if they really, you know, accepted some of these things that are found in that book of mythology, you know, we probably would have a much better society within the U.S. and definitely have a much better society globally. So I know it's like a loaded whatever, but Peter, why is Christmas mythology? Like, why is mythology and why, as somebody that went to divinity school, why don't you support Christianity more? Why don't you support Christmas? What's up with that?
I don't support Christianity anymore, and I'm no longer a Christian because, like you said, I got deep into it as a professional in it, you know, going through the professional degree, the religious training, and then the professional experience in it. As I got deeper and deeper into it, both into the church experience as a professional religious person, as an ordained minister, as I got deeper into the studies of it, I realized just what a fraud it was, and it got to the point where I could no longer tolerate the reality that Christianity, as we know it, is a fabrication, is a total fabrication, and that it is a tool of the domination system. And, you know, America, the United States of America, or as I refer to it, the United States of Atrocities, the USA, is the greatest hegemon on the planet, you know, and the church is a tool of that hegemony around the world. Christianity has been used primarily by the empire from its inception as a means to control people. And if you go back to how Christianity was birthed, it really has little to do with Jesus of Nazareth. You know, people talk about Jesus being born on December 25th. Well, that's part of the mythology. That's part of the narrative, what's made up, the made-up story. Fact of the matter is there's no proof or evidence anywhere of what day or what month, what time of year Jesus of Nazareth was actually born. The reason Christmas is celebrated on the 25th of December is because Christianity was birthed by the Roman Empire. It was born in the Roman Empire, and we could go into some more detail on just how it was birthed. But let me just talk about the date first. In the Roman Empire, the Romans, like most civilizations in antiquity, were very religious, but not religious in the way we understand religion today. Religion was very different in antiquity. And so in the Roman Empire, they had what they called religio, and it was this state religion that incorporated a variety of different religious practices and beliefs and so on and so forth. And those were all accepted and all embraced. And this time of year, in the Roman Empire, there were several major celebrations, several major holidays. And you had Saturnalia, which was a week-long festival between roughly the 18th or 19th of December and about the 23rd, 24th of December. And it was the biggest festival of the year in the Roman Empire, and it was a big party. So we can see Christmas borrowing from that. Also, the 25th, explicitly the 25th, was called the Dies Natalis of Sol Invictus. Okay, so Dies Natalis is simply, we call it basically the birthday, the day of coming forth. Sol Invictus was the supreme Roman god. Okay, and Sol means sun, Invictus means unconquerable. So they saw the sun, and they, there was this sense that the sun was this unconquerable god. Well, that goes right back to, ancient Egyptian religion and, the ancient Kemetic societies. The great god was identified with the sun. And so we see this historical connectivity there. But then all of a sudden, the church takes over several hundred years later after Constantine makes it legal in the Roman Empire, and then the church begins to gain power, and that's a whole other conversation how that happens. But it becomes the birthday of Jesus Christ or Jesus of Nazareth, because it's already an established holiday in the Roman Empire. And so now the church, after beginning roughly in the late 4th century AD, the church has the authority to impose itself on the Roman cultural calendar. And so Christmas becomes the 25th of December, and now instead of people observing the Dies Natalis of Sol Invictus, they're observing the Dies Natalis of Jesus Christ, okay? And we talk about some of these other concept of Christmas. So first of all, the date itself is it's completely fabricated in order to conform to the cultural calendar of the empire. All right, that's very important that we understand the connection to empire there. And then also this concept that Jesus was born of a virgin, the whole Christmas story, Mary was visited by an angel. Well, that's obviously mythology as well. And so if we look back in history, we see that there are a number of societies and cultures in antiquity in which there are miraculous births. Emperors and rulers and leaders, they were considered to have been born miraculously. In fact, if you look at Rome itself, the city of Rome, Remus and Romulus, they were miraculously conceived, and suckled by a she-wolf, in infancy. And so this whole narrative kind of takes on a life of its own. And then that's what the Christians did after the fact, was they divinized this person of Jesus, and they also ascribed to him a miraculous birth. Now, What they did was they justified it by looking at their scripture. And in the Hebrew scripture, there's a philosophy in the book of Isaiah. I believe it's in chapter 7, maybe verse 14. It talks about a young woman shall conceive and bear a child. Well, that's obviously nothing special. That happens every day. Well, when that was translated into the Greek, the Hebrew word, which in English is alma, was mistranslated, actually, Solomon, so that it didn't read young woman anymore, but rather read virgin. All right? So there was basically a glossing or kind of an editing to make the scripture match the politically motivated narrative. So we see the mythology on several different levels there. And also during these Roman holidays, there was gift giving and partying. So there's a clear connection there. And then we also look at other societies who did celebrate the solstice. You know, we look at the colder weather societies in Northern Europe who celebrated they celebrated the solstice, or they observed the solstice, you know, and they brought trees into their house, you know, because they were about to have a long, cold winter. And so they would bring this on the solstice. They would bring what they called the Yule in, you know, this evergreen, as this sign of hope that, you know, there's going to be green in the world again. And, of course, so the church is incorporating all of these various elements of other cultures. So that's a lot of the reason why I say that Christmas is largely mythology and fabrication, because it picks and chooses and cherry picks these elements from other cultures, from other societies, from what have been called pagan observations, and pagan at that concept itself has been completely misunderstood. But at any rate, from these local holidays and local festivals and local celebrations, and keep in mind, again, that it has all been fostered within the context of empire, all right, for the first several hundred years of its existence within the Roman Empire, and then later in the European Empire, and that's when, you know, the European Empire wanted to dominate the world, and so it used Christianity as a form of cultural imperialism, probably the most brutal form of cultural imperialism the planet has ever known. And it used Christianity and stories and narratives and myths like Christmas and the virgin birth and the various other components of Christianity to impose its will on other cultures and on other societies. And that's why we see Christmas being celebrated around the world. You know, and even Santa Claus himself, I mean, that figure has, you know, what does Santa Claus have to do with Christmas? You know, but yet and still it's inseparable. Yeah. With the whole holiday of Christmas, because, again, the church, Christianity, they borrowed all these things, and they're okay with that because it is, again, it's a tool of the empire. And Christmas has more to do with Americanism than it does with Christianity. Or, you know, we might say, you know, Eurocentrism in the bigger context, because, you know, they're cousins. And so... we see all these various things and various facets that have nothing to do with the biblical narrative, that have nothing to do with the tenets of Christianity, and even those that do are the offspring of empire. So that's a big part of the reason why I'm not associated with it anymore, and why Christmas is largely mythology, and why Christianity is largely mythology, Solomon.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And before we welcome on Deacon Christopher Frazier, you know, join us from Oakland, California, I wanted to ask you, I mean, so, you know, as I've said before, you know, two or three times, you know, letting folks know that you're a former pastor, that you, you know, went to divinity school and so forth, and have not read the Bible, but have studied the Bible. You know, there's a big distinction between reading and studying, but you're someone who has studied the Bible. So what, you know, clearly there are pastors, preachers, you know, priests that understand this. I mean, you know, this information, would you call them frauds or are they misled themselves, or, you know, going to divinity school, I'm sure the narrative that you just gave, that wasn't something that was taught to you. So what would you say about these folks? You know, and some of them, you know, there's like a term that goes around about these, prosperity preachers that, you know, preach about, you know, to their congregations, this prosperity, you know, gospel that they can obtain all of this prosperity, you know, if they, you know, so believe, you know, and so forth. So what would you say about them? What would you, like, how would you describe these folks? Are they misled? Are they frauds? Are they charlatans? Do they know this fact and they just use their sheeple or their congregation's misunderstanding of Christmas and the fact that so many people go to these churches wanting to get somebody else's interpretation of the Bible rather than relying on their own interpretation of the Bible, and therefore, I mean, we know most people that go to these churches haven't studied the Bible any length, and they are willing to gain the interpretation of the Bible and the religion of Christianity itself from the pastor, the preacher, or so forth. What is your take on these individuals, Peter, who head these churches?
Well, you know, I think there's a spectrum there, and I think there's a little bit of all of those things that you mentioned, Solomon. I think many folks who are still in church or still in ministry, yeah, they've been misled. They're caught up. They're caught up in this lifestyle, this worldview, this culture. All right, and but they're also definitely are frauds and hucksters and hustlers and charlatans. There's no question about it. When you mention the prosperity gospel, which, you know, to me is an oxymoron, because the message that Jesus of Nazareth was bringing to his people was not about, you know, this concept of American style consumerism, and so again we're seeing Christianity being used as, you know, a tool for a whole different agenda, and but in reality, you know, there's a lot of good people out there who have nothing but the best intentions, who have gone through seminary and divinity school and have read the Bible. But, you know, one thing to understand is that going through seminary or divinity school or training for ministry is very much like being in a cocoon. You know, it's like going to law school. You study law. You know, you don't spend a lot of time studying, much less just casually reading, but you don't spend time studying cultural anthropology, and you don't spend time studying the readings of a diverse range of writers from a diverse range of disciplines and so forth. So, you know, in seminary and in divinity school, those folks going through that stuff, they are, you know, they're in a cocoon, so to speak, and they're not being taught, they're not being given the skills to critically look at this information, this material that is in the Bible. And there are so many contradictions and shortcomings that are, in fact, in the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament. But, you know, as we go through that in school, we're not taught to really critically delve into that. We're not critically taught to compare, you know, these miraculous birth narratives in the Bible with the other miraculous birth narratives throughout antiquity in order to discount the one that's in the Bible. No, we're taught that the one in the Bible, that's the real one. And so there's a lot of people out there that are in church, that are in ministry, who may have heard of some of these other stories. Many of them have not. But they're convinced that because it's in the Bible, that's true. And there's also a lot of ministers out there, Solomon. There's a lot of ministers out there who, when they're pressed, when they're really pressed, and when you get them, you know, maybe you get them in a one-on-one conversation and they're not in front of their congregation, they'll admit to you, well, that this virgin birth stuff is really not, it's not really true. It's not historically accurate. You know, okay, yeah, there are contradictions in the birth narratives between Matthew and Luke, and some of it probably didn't happen, or most of it probably didn't happen. Well, you know, but they're still holding on to their Christianity. They're still holding on to this thing they call church. And that's just something I couldn't live with. I could not continue to be part of a lie, part of a deception. I couldn't I couldn't continue to deceive, and I just had to start telling the truth. And that was part of my downfall, Solomon, as you know. When I started telling the truth to my congregants and in church, I started to get in trouble. And so, you know, I became no longer welcome once people didn't get to hear what they wanted to hear. You know, when I started talking about Jesus of Nazareth being a revolutionary, and instead of, you know, Jesus came to preach prosperity and, you know, peace and goodwill among men, and folks don't want to hear that. So that's a whole other element, that people want to hear what they want to hear. You know what I'm saying? They are comfortable. We get comfortable in our worldviews. And when you start to deconstruct a worldview that somebody's been embraced, that someone has embraced for, you know, decades, for an entire lifetime, whether it's 20, 30, 40, 50 years or more, that's pretty intimidating. That's pretty scary. But that's something that we have to do, Solomon. It's something that critical thinkers have to do. It's something that anyone with any intellectual honesty must do, is to confront reality, confront the facts. And it's just like confronting some of these issues that you touched on at the top of the show, in terms of, you know, what constitutes murder in Connecticut somehow is not murder when it happens in Tehran or in Baghdad or in Yemen. As long as it's, you know, if it's somebody in a soldier's or a policeman's outfit, it's not murder somehow. So, you know, we have to look at facts. We have to look at truth. We have to look at reality instead of looking at our, you know, our society and our worldview in this cocoon, and really be critical about our own reality that we've constructed for ourselves, and make some hard choices. So, answer your question. Yeah, there are some of all of those people out there, and I want to just say this to our listeners at this Christmas time: be intellectually honest with yourself. Don't be afraid to look critically at the things that you've been taught and the things that you've been told. And instead of just reading the Bible, read Roman history, read Greek history, read the history of the Mesopotamian societies, read the history of ancient Egypt. Read those histories, and you begin to put things in context, and then you'll be able to see things in our current society through a different lens. So be critical thinkers. You know, be intellectually honest with yourself, and ask those questions, and don't be afraid to say, you know what? What I've been told and what I've been believing isn't really true. It's not reality. And go out and find reality. Go out and find truth. Go out and find objective historical truth. And that's what I want to get at in terms of this Christmas and some of these other issues that we talked about today, Solomon.
Thank you. Thank you. And with that, I want to welcome on to the show in one moment an individual who's been a longtime supporter of Your World News, and I want to, you know, publicly acknowledge, you know, he's not just been a supporter of the show by tuning in and sending our show's links to all of his networks, but he's also been a monetary supporter. We recently had a fund drive, you know, to help with some of the expenses that come directly out of our pockets, you know, to make Your World News, the whole Your World News outlet possible, the website maintenance, the platform that we use for the radio shows, all that kind of stuff, and this brother, really made a kind contribution to that, as well as also want to thank Nisa Williams, who also made a strong contribution. She's been a longtime supporter of the show. So I want to thank, you know, Deacon Christopher Frazier and Nisa Williams for their support of Your World News. And like I said, folks, we're not corporate supported. You know, we're not looking for corporations to underwrite our show, because we know the moment we do that, you know, that's when we're going to have to start to water down and dilute the narratives and the perspectives and the information that we disseminate on Your World News, and the work that we do in general. And so this is really a community. It's called Your World News because it's yours. It's, you know, we see it as something that is part of the community. And so that's why we're so open to people calling in from the community with issues that they would like to see raised on the show, and even if they want to come on the show and talk about those issues, you know, we are an open platform, and so we you know, with that being said, you know, those that are willing to give a little bit, you know, a donation here and there, goes a long way. And, you know, like I said, when I say a little bit, I'm talking about just a little bit, really, literally goes a long way towards our monthly expenses. So with that being said, I'd like to welcome on the show Deacon Christopher Frazier. Brother Frazier, can you hear me? Let's try this one more time. Let's see.
Yes, sir.
All right. Can you hear me? You're on Your World News with Solomon and Peter Fowler. Welcome to Your World News, and I hope you heard my introduction of you because I wanted you to hear how much we truly support. I mean, we truly appreciate the support that that you've given Your World News. You know, pretty much, you know, since our inception, you know, 3 years ago. So I just want to thank you so much.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. I appreciate love you, my dear brother Solomon. I appreciate love my dear brother Fowler, and my, I don't know if brother Tim is on the line, but I appreciate love him as well, and all the work that all of you all do. It is my pleasure to give whatever support I can, and it is my pleasure to join this mind expansion discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. And with that being said, I'm going to take the first question and give it to you, and then Peter, you know, has a question of his own to ask you. We actually have a few questions that we'd like to ask you. And first, I would like to start off, you being a deacon, somebody who also has studied the Bible and studied Christianity for a long time, and you also being somebody who I would describe as just throughout the years of knowing you, as a strong, proud African man, a Pan-African, can you tell us what the African origins of not Merry Christmas, but Merry Christmas, as you've described in the past before, M-A-R-Y hyphen Christ hyphen Mass, Mass, M-A-S-S. What are the African origins?
The work of Brother Ashra Kwesi, I would cite. He's a wonderful black man, African brother, researcher of our African history, and his beautiful wife, Merira Kwesi. He has a work out called Judaism, the Stolen Religion from Africa, and Christianity, the Stolen Religion from Africa. As both of you all know, Africa is the root of science, medicine, education, and religion. That being the case, when you look at Merry Christmas, from what I can understand, it is really a conflation of three words: Mary, as in the quote-unquote earthly mother of Jesus; Christ, the title given to Yahshua. You know, his African Hebrew name is Yahshua, and his title in the African Hebrew language is Messiah, which is where we get Messiah, but the African Hebrews translated that through the Greek language as Christos or Christ, and then Mass. Now, what is key is to go into the definition of the words. The European scholars, King James, Shakespeare, and others, writing a translation into the English to hide things, camouflage things, change things. But if you go to the Strong's Hebrew Greek Dictionary and Lexicon online, you can see exactly the words that the English is translated from and get the exact definition in the African Hebrew language or the European Greek language. I'm confounded every week when I preach and call up the scriptures online in the Strong's Hebrew Greek Dictionary. I'm confounded and saddened as well, because you think a word means a certain thing because of the English, but when you go into the original African Hebrew or the European Greek, depending on whether it's the Old or the New Testament, it boggles the mind as to what the word really means. Now, Mary is from the African Hebrew Miriam, and it means rebellion, because Mother Mary or Miriam was a revolutionary that was seeking to have a child that would change the course of history for her oppressed people. You all spoke, I began to hear you all at about 20, 23 minutes after. So I didn't hear the previous part, but I'm sure it was beautiful. But that which I heard concerning Yahshua being a revolutionary, that's what Mother Mary wanted. So her name means rebellion. And so Christ, Yahshua, the Christ movement, means is a movement of rebellion against Caesar, against Rome, against colonialism, against slavery, and against exploitation. Now, when you get to Christ, which in the Greek is Christos, which means anointed in the Greek, but when you go to the root of Christos, you get Creo, which is under the number 5548 on the Greek side of your Strong's Hebrew-Greek dictionary. It means anointing. But when you go to the root of that, you get to receive, alone, to borrow. So this anointing, we're borrowing. And the Most High is borrowing us for the purposes of the Most High, which is to deliver the oppressed from the oppressor. When you go to the root of that, there's more roots, but I'm going to stop at this root for Christ. The word is care, 5495. It's feminine, and it is equivalent to the African-Egyptian mayat, which means truth, justice, and righteousness. It's feminine, symbolized by a black woman with wings. And this word in the Greek, care, is the helper agency of one by means of anyone. God symbolizing his might, activity, and power in creating the universe, upholding and preserving the universe, punishing and determining and controlling the destinies of men. What is interesting is that this is also translated as hand. When you research the word hand in the Greek, this power is in your hands. This power, this universal power of Christ to deliver the oppressed from the oppressor based on truth, justice, and righteousness of the universe that our African ancestors scientifically studied and preached that every human being had this divine power to control the destinies of men, meaning maneuver sisters and brothers into freedom, justice, and equality. And it was so interesting to see that this word is feminine and is equivalent in definition to mayat. Now, mass, as we all know, is a mass of people. And the word church, iglesia, Greek, or synagogue, or temple, these are gatherings of people that were to gather together to overturn the power of the oppressor. And all of this knowledge, Christmas, is based on, as my dear brother Father said, the solstice. And our African ancestors studied the solstice, studied the sun, moon, stars, and planets, and began to extract knowledge from creation, or from the stars, sun, moon, so on and so forth. And so your creation and the universe, that's the first scripture, the first spiritual text, or the first scientific text. And I can go more into detail if you would like, but the whole Christ story is first told in the heavens and is not only applicable to one individual that quote-unquote lived 2,000 years ago, but is applicable really to every human being, because this is the birth, rebirth, and resurrection of the messianic spirit of life, light, wisdom, and understanding that raises us up into being gods and goddesses, children of the Most High on this earth. So it's the African ancestors that taught this whole reality. So I come back to Mary, not Merry Christmas, but Mary the Rebellion, Miriam. And then Christ, that revolutionary anointing power and spirit to deliver the oppressed from the oppressor. And mass, we as a mass group of people, not just quote-unquote Christians, but when you understand the definitions of these words, you say Muslim, you can say Hebrew, Jew, Hindu, Buddhist, Krishna, it doesn't, socialist, communist, Republican or Democrat. We rise above these symbols, these words that are just labels, and then we come together as a mass to overturn this no-good, rotten system and deliver the oppressed from the oppressor.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Peter?
Yes, Brother Christopher, thank you for coming on. It's my pleasure to finally get to interact with you. I'm glad you're here with us.
Yes, sir. It's my pleasure as well.
All right. Let me ask you. You mentioned mayat and you know that comedic concept of mayat and truth, justice, and righteousness, and the how important that is in the Jesus movement. Well, Yeshua and his deliverance of his people from an unjust system. And we have an opportunity to try to embrace Mayotte as one of the core principles of that consciousness out of which he came. How do you approach folks with your ministry, with your preaching, and what you do with that tension between those roots in that struggle for deliverance, and then with Christmas time in America, that seems to be nothing more than a lot of consumerism and Americanism on steroids. You know, how do you go about breaking through that hypnotic trance that most Americans are in, especially around the concept of conspicuous consumption and the shopping craze and materialism that Christmas is for so many people?
Well, you go into what the man Yahshua taught. You go into what the scriptures teach, that certainly one can enjoy MP3s, computers, whatnot. But what we try to get over is we don't want to take on the mentality of the wicked ruling class and ruling families that want us to just consume, and care not that these are the products of warfare, bloodshed, death, hell, and destruction. If you research, and I'm sure you have, my dear brother Fowler and my brother Solomon, research the word idolatry in the New Testament. It has to do with that meat that is half burned. The meat that is given to the people is half burned or consumed by the fire. That the meat was given over to the idolatry ritual. And so that's really a symbol of a system of consumerism that is the product of bloodshed and warfare, in that when these bombs drop, it burns the people's flesh. It destroys the people's society, civilization, economy, so on and so forth, family, villages. And so when we go and just consume and don't care that these are the products of America's foreign policy, domestic policy, taking advantage of slave wage, low wage labor, CIA overthrowing governments, military sent to kill. You know the story. You all that listen to world, your world news, I know you know the story. So we raise that up as the reality. Yes, you enjoy your MP3 and whatnot, but know where it came from. Your diamonds, I don't buy any diamonds. Now, that's one thing I would not purchase is a diamond, because you all know the story of the Congo. You know that Paul Kagame was a CIA implant to go back into Rwanda, trained in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, in the late 80s and 90s, sent back 1990 through 1994, encroaching upon Rwanda, sent by Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton. He overthrows the government in 94 in Rwanda, assassinates Habyarimana, and from that time out you have incursions in the Congo, 10 million plus dead. So diamonds I won't buy. So we bring out the reality that these products we have are the product of warfare and bloodshed. And then we bring out the reality that the scriptures, when you read the scriptures for the reality that they are, go into the definitions of the words. I give you one word, the word redemption. Yahshua came to redeem us, or we are redeemed through his blood. Blood is life, not just a man dying someplace, but his life work. But the word redemption or redeem has to do with actually overthrowing illegal laws that are against the laws of life and righteousness. Now, you don't get that in your religious schools, no matter what religious place you go, that the word redemption has to do with the overthrowing of laws that are illegal. These laws that let the wealthy and ruling class run roughshod over the oppressed peoples of the earth, these laws that amount to a new Jim Crow. You all have talked about our beautiful sister. What's my beautiful sister's name? New Jim Crow.
Michelle Alexander.
Yeah, that beautiful sister. So these laws that they create to railroad us into places of disadvantage, they're illegal. And so Yahshua comes to overthrow those types of things and restore truth, justice, and righteousness. So we just bring out the truth and bring the facts to the people and let them decide. as you all do every time you come on the air.
That's right. That's right. Appreciate that. You mentioned Yahshua. What? Why do you refer to him as Yahshua? Why is that the real name and for the person that so many Christians refer to as Jesus Christ? Why do they call him Jesus? What's the misconnection between the two?
Well, most of us who do know that the Hebrew people, they were African people. If you go, I believe it's Amos 9:7, the children of Israel are the children of Ethiopia. So the Hebrews, the African Hebrew Israelites, are African people. So they spoke the Hebrew language, the African Hebrew language. They didn't speak Greek. The African Hebrews translated the scriptures into the Greek so that the Greeks would understand. But his name in his own language that his mother taught him, and his mother's name is Miriam in the African Hebrew language. His earthly father's name is Yusuf. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly in the African Hebrew language. His own name is Yahshua or Yahoshua. And if you look up the word salvation in the Old Testament, it comes out to Yehoshua. If you look up the prophet Joshua and then replace that J with a Y, you get Yahshua. That's the name of Jesus. We call him Jesus. That's his name in the African Hebrew language. But what's interesting is when you go into the definition of his name, Yahshua, which is given as Jehovah is salvation, but when you break it down and you get to some of the words that compile, you have a conflagration of three or four words that come together. It means save, delivered. It means liberated. So we're talking about one who comes to liberate, to bring liberation. Another definition, when you get to some of the other words, has to do with prosperity. Not prosperity gospel, as you all were talking about. Absolutely beautiful dissertation on how the religion is co-opted by the wealthy to cause us to buy into a consumer prosperity narrative that is destructive to the human family. But prosperity meaning that every human being should have equal access to the creation, which is given to us to access equally and not have any one particular group lord over another and take from another portion and destroy another portion of humanity. So he comes to bring prosperity to all, not just one little group, but prosperity, deliverance, because the whole idea is you have a rotten system propagated by Caesar, and in the Greek, the word Caesar means sever. And so Caesar severed and disconnected the Hebrew people from the land, wealth, resources, education, health care. So Yahshua, that name Yahshua, all who believe in liberation, if you were speaking Hebrew, you say Yahshua. All who believe in deliverance, if you were speaking Hebrew, you say Yahshua. So no matter what you call yourself, if you believe in the struggle for freedom, justice, and equality, in the Hebrew, you say Yahshua.
Thank you. Thank you. Peter?
You mentioned liberation, Brother Christopher, and I'm sure you're familiar with James Cone, the great theologian of black theology and black liberation theology.
Yes, sir.
How do you find, in terms of bringing that message, how do you find that people react and respond when you talk about liberation and we talk about redemption in the way that you express it? And you know, this biblical concept of redemption and liberation, and even the biblical concept of prosperity that you just broke down for us. How do you find that people respond to you? Do you find that people are ready to hear that, or is there some trepidation there, or what's your experience with that, and how do you bring that to folks in a way that they can embrace it and understand it?
Well, in my church experience, I've been in church for four decades, never left the church. I was listening to Brother Stokely Carmichael's speech one day he made in the 60s. He said something to the effect of, the revolutionary must be everywhere the people are. And I didn't expect him to say church. He said, if the people are on the college campuses, they must be on the college campuses. If they're in this place or that place, you must be there. He said, if they're in the church, you must be there. So I made that determination to stay in the church and keep this message in the church as well as everywhere. But if you look at the leadership fights it day and night, because the leadership let's just be honest, is really controlled by the wicked ruling class and the families, in that your places that get your religious schools of theology, they're controlled by the wicked ruling class, Rothschilds, Oppenheimers, others who are in that ruling class that control the information. So when you get your papers that validate you as a preacher, rabbi, imam, if you're in the so-called Orthodox community, but these religious places are controlled by the ruling class. So when I go to the most of your preachers who are in positions of authority, they fight it tooth and nail. But some of your like elders and preachers who are not in straight up positions of authority, they'll come to me like Nicodemus. You know the story of Nicodemus coming in the cover of night to tell Jesus in the secret, I agree with you. I like what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing. So there are a few that will come out in secret and say, hey, Deacon Frazier, keep going. Now, your rank and file sisters and brothers, many of them are afraid. Many of them would go after this truth if their pastor would go after this truth. But they're held in check because they don't want to go beyond what their pastor is saying. But even among the rank and file sisters and brothers, I'll get a few that will come to me in secret and say, hey, Deacon Frazier, I like what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing. So but now when you get into just outside in everyday society, most people are comfortable in where they are. They don't want to make waves or they believe in this political party, that political party, whatever the political line is, so it disrupts that. But then there are those who gravitate to the message, as I'm sure that you all have had the same experience. So you just keep plugging at it, and you stay on your post until the Most High calls you home.
Right. I wanted to ask you this question. You know, who are the real Messiah people, and what is their purpose, in your estimation?
This is a beautiful question. The European Jew, we just hit it right at the nail. The European Jew is not the Jew of your Bible. The state of Israel is not the Israel of your Bible. The European Jew is rooted in the tribe called Khazar, K-H-A-Z-A-R. This is a tribe of people out of the Russian Caucasus region who are converts to the Hebrew religion, the African Hebrew religion, 7th, 8th, 9th century A.D., over the years convinced the whole world that they are the Jew of the Bible, Israel of the Bible. Eventually, the state of Israel is established not for righteousness, but to kill and destroy and rape and plunder and destroy and squash revolution and to help Britain and America continue to propagate empire. So the real Hebrew people are the black man and woman of the Americas who fulfilled Genesis 15, 13 through 15, 400 years of slavery. Our slavery began in 1555, not 1619, 64 hidden years in which the breakdown of an African god and goddess into a slave. When you come down through 1865, that didn't end our slavery because Emancipation Proclamation didn't free us, and we went back onto the sharecropping, which is nothing but slavery again. So it's not really until Malcolm X, Dr. King, and others in 1955 began to rise up. 1555, 1955, 400 years. Deuteronomy 28 and 68 says, paraphrasing, that the Hebrew people will go back into slavery, back into Egypt by way of ship. Now, the only, S-H-I-P, ship. The only people as a people that collectively were enslaved by way of ship is the black man and woman of the Americas. So America is our Egypt, as it was in that day when the Hyksos, the black man wasn't on the throne when Moses was fighting the slave master. It was a group of Indo-European invaders called the Hyksos or the Hyksos, H-Y-K-S-O-S. I cite Ashraquasi again. I cite Michael Bradley, Chosen People of the Caucasus. I cite Ralph Shulman and Maya Shon, the hidden history, the true hidden history of Zionism. I cite Arthur Koestler, the 13th tribe. So collectively we come to understand, I cite the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. So when we examine those scriptures, we find that the black man and woman are they who were taken into slavery by way of ship. And as it was then in Egypt, so it is today in America, an invader comes, takes the land from the indigenous, that's the so-called red man, so-called Indian, and then uses slavery to keep the land and become prosperous off the land. Now, that is not said for black people to run around with a big chest. That's a responsibility. The responsibility of the Hebrew people is the same responsibility of the Christ, the Messiah, and we being the Messiah people, is to see every oppressed sister and brother, no matter their color, race, class, ethnicity, creed, religion, political ideology, philosophy, see Christ in every individual and see the God and the goddess Elohim in every individual and work to raise that power out of every oppressed sister and brother that we collectively may realize that power of being the Messiah people and overthrow this system by disconnecting the brains and the minds of the people from the control of the wicked ruling class and families, that we can establish the kingdom of God here and now, right now on this earth.
Thank you. Thank you. Peter?
Yeah, Brother Christopher, thank you for that that historical backdrop. That's all too important, obviously, in understanding how we got to where we are and the way the message has been perverted and contorted. I'd like to take you to a place where we can move us forward now, to the future, all right? You know, this Yeshua said, the kingdom of God is among you. And, you know, for so long, Christianity taught, you know, that, you know, oppressed folks, just bear with your oppression and you get your reward in heaven, right? I mean, and the slave owners in this country told the slaves, you know, just be a slave, don't fight it, that's your lot, you'll get your reward in heaven. But along comes a new message in the 20th century. We hear preachers talking about, in Martin Luther King's words, the beloved community. Could you move us forward and talk about at Christmas time now, okay, what was this that Yeshua was talking about? What kind of beloved community, what kind of kingdom of God should we be working for, and what does that look like? What's it going to look like, whether it comes in our generation or the next generation or sometime in the future? How do you see that unfolding and happening, and when we're going to be when we're redeemed? What's that really going to look like? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, as you stated, Yahshua said, the kingdom of God and John the Baptist, the kingdom of God in heaven is within. Those that controlled the high priest in that day were Caesar and Rome and the Roman elite, Roman Empire. They wanted the people to believe in some, you know, later time, when you go to heaven and come back. But when pressed, when they asked Jesus, when is this kingdom? Where is this kingdom? He said it's within. And the word within in the Greek language, now he spoke Hebrew, but his words are translated into the Greek so the Greeks may understand. But the word within in Hebrew is soul, S-O-U-L. So, and then when you look up the word, as I said earlier, hand, your hand, H-A-N-D, and you see that the word is care, and it's the root to the word Christos that we get Christ. And so all of that is to teach us, as you just said, that power is in your hands right now. The kingdom of God in heaven is within your spirit, soul, your consciousness, your heart. And as we collectively come together and multiply that power, and we win others to this movement, this Christ, this international Christ movement of the kingdom of God in heaven here and now on this earth, we transform society basically back into that which the earth was in its original conception of the Most High in the original creation. As you know, as you all know, Africa, the root of communalism, I heard my brother Solomon say probably a couple of sessions ago, the root of communalism, the root of democracy, true communalism, in which male and female had equal power in society, and those that were quote-unquote leadership were really conduits to raise up the power of the Most High in every male and female, and all had equal access to health care, education, those things that we're struggling for today, equal access to land, wealth, resources. There were laws on the books in Africa that said no leader could rape a woman. I mean, that's a literal law. That would be, is it Chancellor Williams dealt with that in his book? I can't remember the name of his book, but Chancellor Williams did some critical research on that and brought up the original African laws, one of them being no violation of the woman. So when you look at the original society from creation, from original time, long time, who knows how long ago, our age is the same age as the Most High. When you find the age of the Most High, you find the age of the original African people. But that's the type of society that we're going to come to, which is freedom, justice, equality, male and female equality, no death, no hell, no destruction, no warfare, no bloodshed, but true love and friendship. You talked about the beloved community. When we see a sister and brother, we don't say we're colorblind or gender blind or whatever it is. We say, yeah, I see your gender, but I see the value in you coming in your gender and the value in you coming in your color. And we see the value of the Most High in each other, and we look at the differences as that which we must learn about each other to find the commonalities of each other that we may go on together in this beloved community. That's something of, you know, something of what we could say about that.
Right, right. I really appreciate your time today and spending this time with us. I just have one more question, and I believe Peter has one more question as well. My question, I think, is a pretty good segue to what you were talking about when you were talking about the original and the origins. And if you could expound upon the and give your thoughts and whatever background you want to about how Europeans, you know, basically took, you know, the ideas, and this is something that they've mastered, you know, time and time again with other things beyond religion, but how they have taken, you know, they took and most cases misinterpreted the African origins of Christianity, this creation of Christianity. And we know that the Bible is largely, in a lot of cases, like a book of mythology, but, you know, a lot of these ideas have come from, you know, the book of coming forth by day and by night, you know, later translated by, you know, by Europeans to be the, you know, the book of the dead, you know, their negative spin on things. But if you could expound upon the origins of African spirituality and how that was, you know, that was taken by Europeans and how they were even looking at that Aser and Aset, you know, and Heru and so forth, and you know, how these figures and individuals, you know, and these stories were taken and spun into individuals and stories that were, you know, that we find in the so-called King James Bible today. And, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, let's go right to the root and hit this Christ story thing, and I believe we can answer those questions by hitting it right at the root. Now, look, in Acts chapter 7, verse 22, we learn that Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. That's not the Hyksos, but that's his African-Egyptian ancestors. Brother Oscar Kwesi revealed that the first Egyptians, Asar and Aset, came from Ethiopia. So the Hebrews, Ethiopian, original African Egyptians, Ethiopian, these are African people. So he didn't learn this from the Hyksos. Now, that being the case, Moses was learned in all wisdom concerning human civilization, human knowledge, and divine knowledge. When you look up this word wisdom, Sophia, I believe it is in the Greek language, Sophia has to do with even how the Most High governs the universe. So we're looking at solar, lunar, astral science. So the original, and Jesus is learned in the same. He's an African Hebrew. The whole Genesis to Revelation is the knowledge of Moses. And then when you look at the book of Revelation and even the Gospels, Jesus is always coming like the sun, S-U-N. I'm the light of the world. If he's the light of the world, he's coming like the sun. He's equating himself in a spiritual, symbolic, euphemistic sense with the S-U-N of the universe as the S-O-N of the universe coming like the sun, the light of the world. In the book of Revelation, he presents himself symbolically as the sun again, holding the seven stars and the seven candlesticks. A lot of symbology in that. So with that as a backdrop, we come back to the solstice. We come back to the origin of this December 25th reality. And I said reality, not quote-unquote mythology in a negative sense where people say it's unreal. This is a reality. He wasn't born physically on December 25th, but he's coming like the sun every time. He wants you to study zodiac. He wants you to study the solstice. He wants you to study solar, lunar, astral science. So now, December 21st, the sun, after having, it would appear, moving south all this time from spring to this time, getting us to winter, it remains unmoved, unmovable. It remains still for roughly 3 days, December 21st, December 22nd, to December 25th. And then the sun begins to move again, coming back north, it would appear to us. Really, the earth is moving, but in juxtaposition, it would appear coming back north. That's the birth, rebirth, and resurrection of the S-U-N, which is symbolically the birth, rebirth, and resurrection of this light that is illumination, that illuminates the spirit, mind, body, and soul to cause us all to realize this power of the Most High within our consciousness, the kingdom of God in heaven within. Now, the seven stars in the seven star constellation Orion. You have three stars in Orion's belt. Those three stars are referred to as the three kings. And then you have the Sirius star that clues us that the sun is about to resurrect. That is the Eastern star. And so in Africa, the African scientists studied this, and they gave this spiritual reality to us in hieroglyphics. In what you quoted, the book of the coming forth by day and by night, that the Europeans called the Book of the Dead. We get it in Amos chapter 5, verse 8, where it says, "Seek him that maketh the seven stars and Orion." And I won't continue with that verse, but Orion, right there in the scripture. So the three stars on Orion's belt are the three kings. The Sirius star is the Eastern star. The S-U-N, birth, rebirth, resurrection, solstice, December 21st, December 25th, the sun begins to move again. They also say that when it's in that position, not moving, that's its celestial cross. So you get that whole concept of birth of Yahshua, birth or say crucifixion and resurrection of Yahshua. But this is not just a spiritual reality applied to Yahshua. This is a spiritual reality, first of all, to every human being. Every human being is born immaculate. I mean, what did your mother and father have to do with your birth other than they got together? But the reality of your birth, I mean, in Jeremiah 1 and 5, it says the Most High knew you really before conception, knew you before you were formed in the womb of your mother. So that's an immaculate spiritual conception that is not just applied in reality to Yahshua, but to every human being. So this story of the solstice was not just applied to one individual, but as you stated earlier, Heru, 4,500 years B.C. He's given birth on December 25th. This is a spiritual narrative. Not that Heru physically was born on December 25th, but he's coming like the sun. He's coming like the S-U-N. And so spiritually, this spiritual birth, so 4,500 years B.C., Heru. Krishna, 1,500 years B.C. Buddha, 600 years B.C. Quetzalcoatl in Mexico, around 300 years B.C., if I have it correct. And Yahshua, 6 B.C. But this is not just for these individuals to be off in a corner by themselves, but they're raising up Christs, raising up Christians, raising up sisters and brothers who are oppressed, that they may experience the power of the Most High, and collectively we bring the kingdom of God in heaven right here, right now on this earth.
Brother Frazier, I want to I can't thank you enough for bringing that expansive background to this conversation. You've given our listeners, as well as me and Solomon, a whole lot to think about as we go through these next couple days and so forth, and see all the Santa Clauses and sugar plums and candy canes and all that. Hopefully we can start thinking about some of the deep historical realities that you've brought to us. Just can't thank you enough for being with us and dropping all this knowledge. And I want to on behalf of Your World News and Solomon, I want to wish you all the best in your ministry and keep bringing the truth, brother. Keep bringing the real deal. And I know I've learned a lot from having you on today, and I'm going to share a lot of the wisdom that you shared with us. And I know our listeners have gained a lot. So, Brother Frazier, Christopher Frazier, Deacon Frazier, thank you so much for being on with us and for sharing that profound wisdom.
My dear Brother Fowler, I thank you. My dear Brother Solomon, I thank you. And I wish you all the best as we go through and keep this work up. And we're the winner. We are the winner. Make no mistake about it. We are the winner.
Yes.
That's right. That's right. We've got to keep this justice work going, man, and continue to fight injustice at every corner.
Yes, sir.
All right. Take care, brother. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care. I'll be listening to y'all continuously. Y'all love.
All right.
Thank you.
Peter, that was you know, certainly not a common narrative that is that most Christians know about, identify with in any shape, form, or fashion, and unfortunately, far too many Christians of color, and I should be no secret, I am not a Christian, used to be, and the more I learned about Christianity, the more it became a complete contradiction for myself to embrace that King James Bible and that European narrative of religion and spirituality, that they call Christianity, and so I am a spiritual person, but not a religious person, but those that are Christian, Peter, as you know, especially folks of color. That are Christian, whether they are Baptist or Methodist or Catholic. Catholic is a subset of Christianity itself, and they oftentimes, Peter, embrace the most European ideals, and those are the European ideals that have been fed to them. So the European, version of Yeshua, otherwise known as Jesus Christ, so it's common to see that dirty blonde haired looking, pale skinned, white man, on their wall, in their churches, in their home, floating up in the air with a bright light behind him, undoubtedly is a white man. That falsity, that mythology right there. And then, I mean, you want to talk about mythology? I mean, just looking at, and it's amazing, Peter, how people reject and repudiate actual facts, and knowing that region of the world you know this was before the Suez Canal, and this is where before this part of the world was used to be called Northwest Africa. You could literally walk, you could walk from Palestine, into Egypt and vice versa. They were connected. And so the idea that you would have a pale-skinned, dirty blonde-haired individual that is from Bethlehem, that is from Palestine at that time, to look like that is complete mythology. At the very least, his skin would have he would have been a brown skinned man at the very least. And how could he, just looking at their book of mythology, their Bible, how could he blend in with other Kemens, other Egyptians, for 10 years. For 10 years without being spotted at the time when the Pharaoh was, was targeting, Hebrews. How could he blend in if he didn't somewhat look like them, right? It's just, Peter.
Yeah, that's, I'm glad you brought that up, Solomon, because that's one of the cornerstones of the Christian mythology and its efficacy in cultural imperialism in terms of, white supremacy. and the unification of Europe, the unification of all white people under the banner of, you know, white supremacy, was by making this Yeshua Bar Yosef, or Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the son of Joseph, by making him into this white person, into making him European. And that's been one of the greatest crimes of all time. And every time we see that blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pasty, pitiful-looking person that's supposed to be this radical revolutionary Yeshua, we ought to be sickened, and then we ought to be furious. And that's how I feel every time I see that. I feel sickened and I feel furious, because it's brainwashing. It's part of the brainwashing. And if you understand just how powerful, you know, television is today and movies, you know, we know those are powerful. You know, and of course, 1,000 years ago, the domination system didn't have movies and television and, you know, print media and so forth to brainwash folks with. So what they started to use was, Solomon, because, you know, most people were illiterate. Most Europeans were illiterate up until, you know, very, very recently, actually. Up into this last century, you had, you know, major portions of European populations were illiterate. And if you look at it, if you ever walk into either, you know, Roman Catholic Church or a Byzantine Catholic Church, or even some of these older Protestant churches, and you look around, you know, they're covered with this stained glass. And the stained glass windows and frescoes that were painted on the inside of the churches and these murals, that was the television and the movies and the photographs and so forth of yesteryear, that was used before, you know, the age of technology ushered in the technology we have today. But it was those stained glass windows and those frescoes and those murals and those paintings. Okay, Michelangelo painting the roof of the Sistine Chapel, and it's full of white folks. It's supposed to be heaven and creation and Adam and Eve and the hand of God pointing down. Well, how is it that they were all European looking, you know? And so these are some of the great crimes of all time. And you're exactly right. You know, this figure, this pitiful, pasty, pitiful, you know, just sorry looking clown that they say, oh, no, that's what Jesus was. You know, it couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, it's anthropologically impossible that the historical Jesus or the historical Yeshua was a white man. It's just impossible. And so that's one of the things that needs to be challenged. You know, some of the stuff that our brother Fraser just got done talking about, you know, he's challenging the dominant narrative with the things that he's bringing into the story. He's talking about the African roots and these other ancient stories and the things that really were going on back in history and the real meanings of things, you know, and this concept of a white Jesus is one of these things that must be challenged, absolutely must be challenged, because it's just, I was talking earlier about being intellectually honest. Well, if there's a shred of honesty in terms of the way we look at history, then we cannot accept a white Jesus, an amelanic Jesus. It's ludicrous historically. But let me tell you a story, a personal story with regard to that. This happened at the last church I worked at before I finally, had to hang up my robes, as it were. When they called me to this church, we were basically trying to revitalize an urban congregation. And there was a painting on the wall of this, you know, pasty, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pathetic-looking guy. And, you know, they held that this was Jesus, right? Well, it's offensive. This blonde-haired, blue-eyed, supposed to be Jesus is offensive to many people of color, because that is also the face that justified slavery and oppression and exploitation on this continent for 400 years. Just like, Brother Fraser mentioned, going back to 1555, you know, when the first Europeans brought African slaves with them when they landed on this continent, that face, that white face, signifies and justifies that kind of oppression and sociocide, that genocide. And so it can be offensive to people of color, to black folks who have some kind of consciousness and are aware that, no, the Jesus, the Yeshua of the Bible, the Yeshua of history was not a white man, all right? He was definitely a man of color, no question about it. So at any rate, I took this picture down. I took down this painting that was on the walls of the church. Solomon, don't you know some of the white, most of the white folks were livid. They were absolutely livid. They couldn't believe why I would do such a thing, that I took their white Jesus down off the wall. I didn't make a big deal out of it. I didn't make an announcement. I didn't, you know, throw it into a fire. One day during the week, I just removed it. And then on Sunday, after church on Sunday, there was an uproar. There was an absolute uproar. I virtually had a mutiny on my hands. And that event right there, that event spelled the end for me at that church and pretty much in any church at that point. Even though when I sat down with a couple of the deacons who came to me and said, you know, why would you do such a thing? And I tried to explain to them, you know, that our members that were black and the people from the neighborhood who were coming that are also African American, I said, this is offensive. You know, this is not welcoming. And they couldn't understand it. They couldn't come to grips with that reality, with that fact. And then when I tried to explain to them that, you know, any historical Jesus certainly didn't look like this, they were absolutely, it was like I was speaking another language. They just couldn't understand it. It didn't make sense to them. So it gives you some idea of just how powerful that really is, that image, and just how powerful it's been in the brainwashing of people for you know, centuries now. And it's something that we must challenge. It's something we must challenge. I'm glad you brought that up.
Right. So I appreciate that story, and I've heard that story from you before off air. And once again, I just want to say bravo to you. If there, you know, some things are worth getting kicked out of, you know, some actions are worth doing, you know, even if it means being kicked out. And that's one of those actions. That is one of those actions. Just like, you know, when you look at, you know, another man of the cloth, Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, he knew that his speaking out against war and imperialism and those type of things, and that once he did that, it was most likely going to prevent him ever from being invited back into the White House that was occupied by LBJ at the time.
Yeah.
And so I want to shift focuses, you know, since we're speaking about war and imperialism and things, and even the presidency of the United States of America, it's supposed to be a separation of church and state, but every American president puts their hand on a Bible and they are sworn in. And as we move towards the second inauguration of the first phenotypically brown president of the United States, the first, you know, so-called African American to hold the title president of the United States of America, Barack Hussein Obama. Well, Peter, this man is quite interesting. He is a devout, by his terms, is a devout Christian. You know, he makes no bones about it. But as we were saying before, at the start of the show, the contradictions that reside even within those that consider themselves Christian, the vast majority of them have accepted, you know, war and killing and death and murder by the hands of a government that they continue to seemingly be more obsequious to than their own mythological Bible. And now, as we have before, not any different, but this is a face of color. This is a African American president who is carrying out the same atrocities as presidents before him. This is a president who has revolutionized, in a very bad way, not a good revolution, but he has really taken the whole use of drones, of predator drones, to a whole nother level, to a whole nother meaning and scope, beyond you know, that of George Bush. I mean, this was you know, unbelievable to a lot of us that there would be somebody that could actually take it to another level outside of the Bush-Cheney administration. But this man has used drones in a way, you know, much like you and I breathe. You know, it's just innate, it's intrinsic, and has taken lives after lives, has executed more drone attacks than George Bush ever did here, Peter. And this is where I try to compose myself, and you know, without going off the deep end. He has, you know, killed children in Pakistan. He and George Bush have combined for, you know, the killing of at least 178 children in Pakistan alone, dating back to 2005 by Bush, and then Barack Obama picked up the baton, and then Barack Obama executed more drone attacks in his first year in, as president than Bush did in his entire tenure. So he's killed people in Pakistan, and let's say, like, you know, children in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen. You know, he killed, you know, and all children's lives are the same. I don't see an American child's life any more valuable than a child from Yemen or Pakistan. But you know, an American child, you know, 16-year-old boy, you know, was killed in Yemen by way of his orchestrated, ordered drone attack there. So it goes on and on and on and continues to, and he has no contrition whatsoever. Why have contrition for something that you don't think is wrong? So it's clearly that he doesn't think it's wrong. I mean, the last presidential debate between him and Mitt Romney, I mean, they beat their chests basically extolling the use of drones and that they were both strong supporters of that. So Peter, we have this tragic event that happened last week that killed so many children, most of which were white children. I say that because I want to compare and contrast something. That if children's lives are all the same, and you so-called Christians out there are against, you know, killing, and even the non-Christians, the folks that you say that you love, you know, the children and their lives, and you want to protect the children and their lives. Like, is that really so? Does your president believe that? Does the president of the United States of America believe that when he had his press conference that Friday, and then he had another press conference in Newtown, Connecticut, when he was, beside himself, was on the verge of shedding tears? About these children and saying that these tragedies, these massacres must come to an end. Was he really sincere about that, Peter, folks there listening? Was he really sincere about that if at the same time he continues to oversee a war machine and he directly has given orders to not just do drone strikes but airstrikes? And has shown no contrition whatsoever, no remorse to the lives lost, the children's lives that have come to an end directly from United States of America's military machine. I mean, this is a question that begs to be asked. This is a question that needs to be answered. This is a question that those of you that continue to support him and to make excuse after excuse, those of you that consider yourselves, you know, people of religion and as if that makes you more of a moral authority than somebody that's not, you know, then you must ask yourself this question. Where are your tears? Where is your continued outspokenness that we've seen that has emerged in the last week, outspokenness against the use of guns and pushing for stricter gun laws? Well, you cannot, and I'll come to the end on this, Peter, you cannot, unless you are a damn fraud, and you are a damn fraud that has been built up by frauds who have fed you lie after lie, and because you lack the basic ability to critically think. If you do not address stricter gun laws in this country without connecting them to stricter laws that pull in the reins of the United States military machine and its imperialist goals. If you cannot talk about stricter gun laws here without talking about stricter reins and pulling in the reins and bringing to an end the use of much more powerful weapons than that of a Bushmaster, than that of a Glock or a handgun. We're talking about weapons that are missiles that take out entire wedding parties, that take out entire funerals, that take out entire villages, all right, in one fell swoop. Unless you have just lost your mind and lost your morality and are just a selective human being, a selective Christian, a selective whatever, you know what I'm saying? Unless you're just one of those, then you must look yourself in the mirror and from this moment on become a completely outspoken critic against this country's war machine that, yes, is taking children that are also 5 and 3 and 1 and 9 months old and 7 years old and, you know what I'm saying, and 6 years old and 16 years old that have been taken out. Where is your outspokenness? If it's been there, then bravo to you. Keep up the good work. You have our support. If it hasn't been there, then you need to check yourself. You need to check yourself, and then once you check yourself, check the people around you, the people that are closest to you that have not been doing this. Check yourselves. Check yourselves, because it reeks of hypocrisy. We already know your president is a big, fat hypocrite. Figuratively fat, of course, is a hypocrite. Is a hypocrite of monumental proportions. Okay? Monumental proportions. He is a mass murderer. He is a killer. The U.S. military machine is a killer. It is a mass murderer of historic proportions. So the same way that kid Adam Lanza massacred those children, and we at Your World News, Peter and myself included, mourn their loss. Mourn their loss. Adam Lanza took their lives, tragically took their lives, horrifically took their lives. Well, in the same way, but just in a much more precise and expansive way, Barack Obama is not so different. Not so different, but in a real crazy way, Peter. Though it's even more pathological. It's even more of a sociopath, because sociopaths oftentimes can justify their motives, and they don't think twice about them, Peter. And you know, when you look at the U.S. war machine, starting with Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton and the like, and all those folks there that control and operate it, Peter. They convince themselves that they're doing the right thing, that they're doing the right thing. They've convinced themselves not even to think about the innocent loss of life, man, woman, elderly, and, yes, children, you know, and so-called far-off places, far away from the United States' manufactured shores. In a even more sadistic and sick way, these people who are not taking any psychotropic drugs, at least I don't think they are doing these killings with clear minds, lucid minds, which means that inherently they're evil. Peter?
They are. There's no question about it. By any standard, we have to identify that as real evil. And also we need to identify you know, you mentioned being sociopaths, and that's the truth. And, you know, we have to understand that Americanism is a pathology. You know, all this ideology that allows for, not only allows for, but celebrates murder by the state, because that's what war is. There's no war on terrorism. War is terrorism. All right? So murder perpetrated by the state is not called murder, right? It's called defending America's interests or prosecuting the war on terror or some other such nonsense, all right? And so there's an ideology that is adopted and embraced and imposed upon a people, to justify wanton killing, to justify mass murder. And that's what we're seeing around the globe. At the, so that's murder by America. And then when, you know, and then when we hear about stories of murder in America, everybody seems surprised, Solomon. But you know what? The only thing that surprises me is the things that happened in Connecticut don't happen more often. But the truth of the matter is we just saw a shooting, what, a few days before that at a mall in Oregon. And then a few weeks before that was the shooting at the movie theater in Colorado. And, you know, we could call the roll. There's shootings like that all the time. There's shootings like that on a regular basis. Now, not all of them involve the killing of a dozen or more people or numbers of children. Some of them only happen one or two at a time. And somehow it's okay, and it doesn't make headlines, and it's not sensational when you wake up and read your morning newspaper and another and two or three more people, most likely going to be black or brown-skinned people, got shot overnight. The city of Chicago has already witnessed over 400 murders in 2012 alone. Maybe the number is up to 500 by now. Now, where's the sensational media story around that? It's not happening. It's okay to kill Americans one at a time. And it's certainly okay to kill black Americans. You know, if you look at the statistics for the cause of death for black males between the ages of 17 and 25, it's violence. Manslaughter, murder is one of the leading causes of death for young black males. How come that's not a sensational story in the media? Because it's okay.
That's right.
It's okay. And that is symptomatic of a pathology. That is symptomatic of a society that's run by sociopaths and is populated by delusional people. Of course, Barack Obama is a hypocrite. His predecessors have been hypocrites. George Bush Jr., Bill Clinton, George Bush Sr., Ronald Reagan, and every president before that has been a massive hypocrite, all the way back to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and those jokers who wrote those famous words, all men are created equal, while what? While they were owning slaves at the very same time.
Yeah.
Now, see, there's a continuity of consciousness here. While Washington and Jefferson and Adams, while they could write the words, all men are created equal, while at the same time they owned slaves, and also keep in mind that in the 1700s, in the 1770s, 1780s, after the founding of the United States, not just before, but, you know, not only were slaves property, not only were black people completely disenfranchised, whether in the North or the South, but women were also considered property. Our children were considered property. So there's you talk about hypocrisy. This nation is founded on hypocrisy. It's built on hypocrisy, and it's fueled by violence. This nation was born in violence. This nation was born under a policy of extermination of the indigenous people here. We've talked about that on as we construct the so-called Thanksgiving holiday every year, about how this nation was birthed in bloodshed to exterminate the native population so that the Europeans could invade and occupy this nation. And then they stole much of Mexico from the Mexicans. You know, and then they brought over Africans to do, you know, all the labor for them for free and consider them subhumans and property. You know, so hypocrisy has a long and storied history in this country. So Barack Obama simply stands tall in the saddle of hypocrisy that goes back to the very beginnings of this nation. You know,
right.
And you want to talk about gun laws? Seriously? Tightening up gun laws? Really? No, this nation is sick. This nation is pathological. This nation is built on violence. It's fueled by violence. Well, you know what? One of the most popular toys and gifts going to be this Christmas are those video games, you know, Black Ops and, you know, all those war videos. I don't even know the names of them. But, you know, what's the point of all those? It's killing people. It's killing the other. You know, 500 years ago, the other was the native people on this continent and on the islands, and it was okay to kill them because they were the other. and the labor that was brought over from Africa, it was okay to enslave them and to exploit them because they were a cultural other. And during the Crusades, the church justified killing the Muslims or any non-Christians because they were other than us. And here we are in the 21st century with the president of the so-called freest country in the world, right, of a democratic country, still pursuing a policy of systematically exterminating the cultural other. It's okay to kill Afghans. It's okay to kill Iraqis. Even Madeleine Albright, in the face of a question, was it okay to kill a 500,000 Iraqis from the sanctions that were imposed on Iraq for over a decade? She said, what, Solomon? We believe it was worth it.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm just surprised. You know, I'm not surprised at what happened in Connecticut. I'm not surprised at all. It's inevitable, and it will continue to happen because America is sick.
You're right.
And bring it back to the whole Christmas theme, Christianity is part of the sickness. It helps justify the sickness. That Barack Obama can consider himself a Christian and then review a kill list every week to send, you know, drones and bombs and continue to be the proud commander in chief of a horde of mass murderers that we call the military. That is sickness, Solomon. That is sickness. That is pathology. That's just sickness.
That's right.
That's America.
That's right. I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. I could not agree more. And at this juncture, he is what he is. And with our conversations off air, my displeasure is more so with those that continue to just support him, regardless of what he does, and continue to make excuses. And they've exposed themselves. I mean, these individuals expose themselves for who they are. They're supporters of mass murder, and in their world, and in their world, the lives of Americans, especially white American children, is much more valuable. Is much more valuable in their eyes, in their world, than all the lives of brown and black skinned children, in different parts of the world who have perished and unfortunately will continue to perish by way of U.S. militarism, and that includes drones and airstrikes and night raids and so forth. Where were their tears when the U.S. was bombing, you know, Tripoli and back to friggin', into oblivion? Bombing into oblivion, setting it back decades, if not an entire century. Where were they? You know, and now where are they now that there's a civil war that's going on in Libya, where those who are supporters of Gaddafi, including many black Africans, are being mass targeted and have been targeted, even during that whole campaign, were being targeted, and black women having their breasts cut off and gang raped by those terrorist thugs that the U.S. was supporting. Where are the tears now? Nothing. No tears whatsoever. You hit the nail right on the head, Peter, when you said it's a sick society. It is a sick society. It is a sick society, and so-called leaders have exposed themselves. Those of the likes of these talking heads. I didn't like to call them leaders, but those folks that you see paraded around on MSNBC and CNN as if they are some kind of liberals, they are liberals. All right, to me, liberal is not a good word. It's not a good title to carry around in any shape, form, or fashion. But these individuals who are looked to by these dumbed down, non-critically thinking Americans as looking as those are somehow significant alternatives to Fox News. The people that are on these shows, whether it's Anderson Cooper, whether it's Al Sharpton, whether it's Melissa Harris Perry, whether it's Ed Schultz or Rachel Maddow, these so-called liberals, black and white, they're nothing but a bunch of warmonger supporters. They support warmongering. They supported the campaign in Libya. They support the U.S. financing of the same terror, of many of the same terrorist rebels that we saw in Libya. We see them now in Syria. They support all of that stuff, Peter. And so where is the nation crying out for the countless incidents that happen each year regarding police brutality imposed upon black and brown communities, and some of which you know end up in fatalities in places like, you know, the place in Cleveland, Ohio, where Peter, you're very familiar with the lay of land in Ohio, whether it's Dayton or Columbus or Cleveland. And Peter, I want to play this clip, and I want to get your feedback on it from it. And folks that are listening right now, I want you to listen to this clip. This happened a few weeks ago. And where was the national outcry? And unfortunately this is not a novel thing that happened in Cleveland. This is something that happens all too often in America. But where is the mass outcry of innocent life that is being that is lost year in and year out? The loss of black and brown life, people of color who are killed unarmed by the state-sponsored police. This police operates no differently, you know, in many ways than that of state-sponsored police in places like, you know, under the Shah and his secret police, his SAVAK. So I'm going to play this, Peter, and I want to get your feedback on this.
In the year 1900, the great black activist and journalist Ida B. Wells wrote an article called Lynch Law in America. It began with these words. Our country's national crime is lynching. It is not the creature of an hour, the sudden outburst of uncontrolled fury, or the unspeakable brutality of an insane mob. It represents the cool, calculating deliberation of intelligent people who openly avow that there is an unwritten law that justifies them in putting human beings to death without complaint, under oath, without trial by jury, without opportunity to make defense, and without right to appeal. In Cleveland this week, 13 police officers, 12 whites and one Hispanic, fired 137 bullets at a black man and woman after a high-speed car chase. No weapon was found on their bullet-riddled bodies. Community members charged the victims were lynched. Less than 2 weeks before, in Jacksonville, Florida, a white man who didn't like black teenagers playing loud music at a gas station fired 8 or 9 shots at 17-year-old unarmed Jordan Davis, killing him. The middle-aged shooter claimed he was justified by Florida's Stand Your Ground law that allows white people to act out their fears, their hatreds, or their mood swings with impunity. The same claim made by another Florida gunman when he executed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin without trial or right of appeal. Young Trayvon drew his last breath in time to be listed among the 120 black people known to have been extrajudicially executed in the first 6 months of this year, one killing every 36 hours. The report, compiled by a handful of people for the Malcolm X grassroots movement, had to be pieced together from news clippings and other sources. That's because there is no database on the extrajudicial killing of African Americans, a practice that is not considered a crime based on America's unwritten law. In fact, it's treated even more casually than a sport. At least in sports, they keep statistics. Ida B. Wells kept statistics. She and a few colleagues tallied 3,436 lynchings of blacks in the 33 years between 1889 and 1922. 83 of the victims were women. Lynching reached its high watermark in 1892, when 160 African Americans were slaughtered because of their race. That number will be far exceeded this year at the rate the blood is flowing. The Malcolm X grassroots movement had hoped to follow in Ida B. Wells' footsteps with their report. They reasoned that armed with the facts, black folks would get fired up enough to launch a modern-day movement against lynching, just as Ms. Wells' work propelled lynching to the center of the movement of her day. But the 2012 report failed to reach many people, because it was largely ignored, not just by the corporate media, but by much of the so-called progressive media and traditional black leadership. That's because, in the early 21st century, only certain types and classes of black folks are likely to be extrajudicially put to death, or consigned to the social death of America's black prison gulag. Poor people like Melissa Williams and Timothy Russell, snuffed out like vermin in the black-run city of Cleveland. For them, lynching remains the national crime and the unwritten law. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Peter, I'll let you take the stab at that first.
Yeah, obviously much props to Glenn Ford for another great piece and all the, his work. It's interesting, Solomon. Just earlier today I was reading a piece by Ida B. Wells. Something she wrote in 1910 and her anti-lynching crusade. And the piece I was reading is called Mob Law in Lincoln's State. And her point was that the most lynchings on record at that point in the U.S. had been recorded in Illinois, which, of course, is the so-called land of Lincoln. You know, and I think she was kind of using that angle to say, oh, my God, you know, how could this happen in the land of Lincoln, right? Look at this discrepancy here. You know, Lincoln freed the slaves, right? Well, it just points again to the hypocrisy and the deception and the delusion that is this, you know, this the state of America, this American dream, that even in the land of Lincoln, lynching was running rampant. And here we are, you know, a century later, as Glenn pointed out, a century later, and lynching doesn't have the, it doesn't look the way it did in 1910 or the 1890s or the 19th century. But we're seeing these extrajudicial killings, these killings that are taking place, black folks, brown folks being murdered on a regular basis, one every 36 hours. Just, you know, just pause and try to wrap your mind around that for just a moment. One every 36 hours. That's an extrajudicial killing by a police officer or some kind of official or somebody like, you know, like those cases in Florida where, you know, it's just a matter of course. And again, Solomon, I'll go back to my point earlier that these are symptomatic of a sick society. And the fact that the media does not treat those incidents like it treats, like it is currently treating the case in Newton, Connecticut, you know, and I'll tell you what, that happened a week ago, and it is still the leading story in many of the news media outlets. It's still being bandied about on the talk shows and in the op-eds and editorials and so forth, and it's still the frame of the news on a daily basis, and it probably will be for a few more days to come. Maybe once Christmas passes, it'll subside, or the next big thing comes along. But, you know, that points up a whole lot of other problems, too. But, yeah, my hometown of Cleveland, that's obscene, Solomon. That is an obscenity. 137 bullets unleashed by 13 different officers. That's obscene. That's like a battlefield scene right there. 137 bullets. Yet and still, that story wasn't important enough to make the national media cycle and to be a national outrage. And so, you know, all these killings, we got guys in Florida who, you know, they just carry guns as a matter of course. And when they see a black kid that they don't like or who's listening to the music that they think they should turn out, then they shoot him.
That's right.
That's the way it is in this society. It is symptomatic of a sick society, you know, and just this very, just the conversation, the fact that we have to have this conversation about, oh, well, should there be stricter gun laws or that is also symptomatic of the sickness that is Americanism, you know, because we're going to be hearing that for the next several months, and they're going to be going back and forth about restricting gun laws and so on and so forth. Well, it's interesting that that conversation only comes up once a bunch of white kids are shot.
Yeah.
Only once a bunch of white children, and in this case, teachers who are mostly women, in a middle-class or upscale suburb in Connecticut, when they're shot up, all of a sudden we have to have this national dialogue, and the president comes on and says, oh, we have to make changes. No changes had to be made after 137 bullets were fired by police into an innocent victim, an armed victim. You know, none of that language took place after Trayvon Martin or Jordan Davis were shot.
The list goes on.
So it's symptomatic of a sickness, Solomon. It grieves me, especially to hear what happened in Cleveland, my hometown. But all of these killings grieve me and ought to grieve us just as deeply as the killings in Newton, Connecticut.
That's right. That's right. No mass discuss. I mean, you're right, Peter. And it's infuriating. It's infuriating and on so many levels. On one level, it's completely infuriating, you know, that we dwell within such a sick and white supremacist and just a viciously racist society. I mean, I'll venture to say it is one of the most racist societies known to man. I mean, and anyone that wants to say that I'm exaggerating, or that's some kind of hyperbole, you know, you need to really go, you know, reassess, you know, your understanding about race in America and what this country's track record is when it comes to just brutal racism, not just in the past but currently. And so, you know, and I say that because, Peter, you bring up something very instructive. Like, this is, you know, rightly so. You know, you have these children that you know, and adults that were massacred, and rightly so. You know, you would expect an entire nation to mourn if that entire nation sees themselves, you know what I'm saying, you know, as a part of that community, or sees that community as a part of them, as they see, you know, Newtown, Connecticut. Now here's the thing. We obviously know that that's not true with all demographics in the U.S. So when you have like a Sean Bell, or Oscar Grant, Amadou Diallo, Timothy Stansbury, and Ayanna Stanley Jones, I mean, we can go on and on. It's crazy. I can just run these names, you know, Trey Joyner. I mean, just on and on and on. Kia Boyd. I mean, we can just go on and on and on, Peter. So there's this national dialogue now, Peter, where the president immediately, Peter, creates this, you know, this task force, and the task force is going to be headed by Joe Biden, you know, one of the same architects that wrote the crime bill, the omnibus crime bill in 1994. You know, that's a complete another story. But so he immediately has this task force to address gun violence. So Peter, if all Americans are seeing the same, and all loss of life, especially the loss of life of children and innocents, civilians, you know, is seen the same, then, Peter, where was the national dialogue regarding the policing in America in terms of incidents that have happened while he's been in office, you know, such as Ayanna Stanley Jones? That was, you know, May of 2010. There was no national dialogue. I don't even believe that he said anything about her in any shape, form, or fashion. No. That little black girl didn't deserve, in you know, for Barack Obama, you know, he you know, she didn't deserve any kind of you know, any kind of you know, open mourning from him, any kind of words in a press conference, you know, mentioning her or her family, this, that, and the other. No, not at all. And a matter of fact, as candidate Obama in 2008, in the summer of 2008, when the verdict of the Sean Bell shooting, you know, was laid down, when Judge Cooperman, I believe his name was Arthur Cooperman, basically allowed, you know, just basically said that you know, these officers are not to be held accountable. They're not going to do any jail time. They're not to, you know, they're, you know, and basically, you know, and the same thing with the, you know, in Rodney King verdict style. I mean, the same thing. They were allowed to go. They, you know, without, you know, without any kind of justice being served in any shape, form, or fashion. And it was Obama, candidate Obama, when asked on the campaign trail that summer, he had the audacity, when black people were out in mass in New York, and they were in mass peacefully, there was no riots or anything like that, but he had the audacity, so there was no justification for him to say what he said. You know, it was said, you know, that you know, we need to respect we. You know, he said used the pronoun we as if he was a part of that community, a part right. of that mourning and that suffering. Right. We need to America is a land of just laws, and we need to respect the verdict of the judge. Now, Peter, that's just incredible that we need to respect the verdict of the judge, as if the judge is this extraterrestrial, like, you know, being, this entity that is not a human, that is not fallible, and we need to respect his ruling. That's like saying that we need to respect the ruling of you know, racist, amoral judges that have levied some awful rulings in the past that have been completely racially motivated in the past, that have allowed lynchers and those who have killed black people in the past, those judges who helped uphold and support the institution of chattel slavery. So we're just supposed to – so America is just a land of just laws, right, Peter? It's a land of just laws. This country – no historical context, whatever, Peter. He just – America is a land of just laws. We need – before I divert any more, my thing, Peter, is that is all evidence. That is all evidence of how sick, as you said, this society is, how sick and how racist, how institutionally racist and white supremacist this society is. You even get a black face because he knew that if he said those things, it would continue to allow him to be ingratiated by white liberals from coast to coast. If you are that Negro, if you are that handkerchief-head Negro that is willing to sell out, you know what I'm saying, the interests of suffering that, you know, that comes disproportionately to black and brown communities, if you are willing to not say a word about that, not a peep about that, and definitely not do a damn thing about it, then you will be ingratiated by white liberals and conservatives alike. And so that, in combination with the countless, you know, killings of innocent, you know, unarmed black and brown human beings in this country, and still yet there's no national indictment. There's no national indictment that we need to revisit, you know, how policing is done in this country. We need to have a national dialogue and have a task force for policing. Have a task force to address white supremacy. Have a task force to address institutional racism. Peter, none of it. None of it. Because, and when it comes to it, the bottom of it, as you hit it right on the head, Peter, it comes down to color. Everything has to do about color. If you are not white, too effing bad. Too effing bad. And as last poet said, you know, said before, you know, die, nigga, die. Die, nigga, die. So shut the F up, you niggas. Shut the hell up. We don't want to hear from you. We don't want to hear from you or your suffering. Your suffering is relative. It is relative when it comes to white people and their suffering and their loss of life. It comes down to that. And yes, especially, and so obviously if that goes on within the U.S., Peter, then clearly we should not be surprised that ain't no American, you know, most Americans, and certainly not the president, who is the commander in killing, is not saying a damn thing about the loss of life, about those people, those children who are in, you know, places that are thousands and thousands and thousands of miles, a la Libya, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, on and on and on and on and on. Peter Fowler.
Yeah, you cut right to the root of the issue, Solomon, the fact that America is a pigmentocracy. It's a pigmentocracy. It's about pigment. It is the pinnacle of racism on the planet Earth. I mean, you know, the rulers of the United States of atrocities, the rulers of America are the ancestors of the very system of white supremacy. And so it's no surprise, again, it's no surprise to see these horrific acts of violence that occur on a regular basis. And the color line is what defines what we call murder, what we don't call murder. It defines what gets media attention and what doesn't. It defines what's important or who's important and who's not, just the way you spelled it out. And, you know, we can look at how that same paradigm just gets translated into foreign policy. You're right. It's that cultural other, you know, within the borders of the United States. It's white folks get preference, black folks get sent to prison. I mean, look at the American gulag, as Glenn Ford calls it. The general population is maybe 13% black, between 12.5 and 13% black. What's the prison system population? It's over 50% black. You know, look at death row. Look at the population and the demographics on death row. Look at the demographics of health disparities in this country. I mean, we could go on and on. And the fact of the matter is that the color line distinguishes the have-nots from the have-lots. And until we get that into our minds and really come to grips with that, you know, we're not going to get through it. We're not going to get past it. And unfortunately, the presidency of Barack Obama has helped to squash that conversation, squelch that discussion, rather than to really talk about it. The fact that he paid no attention to the murder of Ayanna Stanley Jones by the hands of the police in Detroit, yet and still, when some white kids get shot up, that speaks volumes. I mean, think about the two occasions when I've heard the federal government make noise about gun control. Have been in the early 80s when somebody's tried to shoot Ronald Reagan, and Brady got hit, one of his aides or cabinet members. And what was the result of that? Oh, we got to have gun control. And then there was the Brady bill, which eventually became the Brady Law, signed into law much later. Why? Because one white guy got shot.
Right.
But he was one of the ruling class. So as soon as a member of the ruling class gets shot, there was gun legislation on the table almost instantaneously.
Right.
And we're seeing it repeated now in 2012 when some children of some fairly well-to-do white people in Connecticut get shot. All of a sudden, the federal government is clamoring along with the rest of America or the rest of white America, oh, my God, we've got to protect the white people. So we see that. Yet and still, how many hundreds of black young people have been murdered just in Chicago alone this year, just in Cleveland alone this year, just in Oakland alone or Miami alone this year? And where's the outrage? So it shouldn't be any surprise. It shouldn't be any surprise that this kind of thing continues to go on today. But what should be shocking and absolutely outrageous to all of us is that our melanic or brown-skinned president is the one presiding over this system of white supremacy, internal and external genocide. That is what is outrageous. That is what is absolutely outrageous, and it is the ultimate indication of a pathological society, that we can put a brown face on systematic murder, whether it's inside or outside of our borders.
That's
that
right.
Really demonstrates the depth of depravity that is Americanism, Solomon.
That's right. And Peter, you know, as we come to a close, like I was just thinking about something, you know, as you were speaking and just kind of reflecting on both our words and what we've discussed, you know, on air and off air. And I think, you know what, you know, we've always been solution oriented here at Your World News and have prided ourselves by, you know, being folks that also do a lot of work in the community, that we don't just hide behind, you know, keyboards or, you know, or you know, telephones. You know, we get out in the community and consider ourselves a part of the community. That I think, Peter, that it would be most appropriate if within the next, I would say the next fortnight, that we arrange an on-air national forum to address address what we said, that, you know, that what we said, if this was a just and non-racist society, there would have been some kind of national dialogue, some kind of national forum, national conversation started somewhere on one of these media outlets, you know, addressing, you know, not just the institution of policing and how policing is done, especially in poor communities and communities of color in general, but also to address the continued legacy of institutional racism and white supremacy in this country, and to address this, to make sure that we continue the conversation or reignite the conversation, so folks know and are strongly reminded that this is not a post-racial, this is not a post-racist, you know what I'm saying, this is not a post-white supremacist society in any shape, form, or fashion. So, Peter, I hope that, you know, that you'd be interested in this, but I think that we, you know, we put it out there, we promote it, you know, well before we do this show, and encourage people to call in, and you know, that could be a good thing or a bad thing, as we harken back on our memories of a disillusioned individual by the name of Sarge calling in from Georgia one time, but we open it up to the broader community and encourage people to call in. With their discussions and their stories of race and racism in America and their stories of policing and police brutality and so forth, and I think it's, you know, FUCK, the corporate media, they're not going to do it, but hey, you know what I'm saying, let's, you know, we've talked about it, we've criticized them, and now let's take it to another level and do what they're not doing. So what do you think about that, Peter?
Well, you know, I'm down for it, Solomon. It's a discussion that needs to be had, you know, because, as you said, the national media, the corporate outlets are not having this conversation. Obviously, people like Glenn Ford and you know, places like Black Agenda Report, they're bringing the news. But it's not out front. It's not a national dialogue, because the national media just refuses to acknowledge it and refuses to accept it and take it where it needs to go. So any effort that we can provide, I'm all for it, and I'm looking forward to it already.
All right, that's going to be great, man. And before we leave, you know, I just want to play one more thing, Peter, and I just want to play one more thing. I'd be remiss, since we're talking about this, and I'm glad that we've gone from Christianity and Christmas to this, because it all melds together. And folks, just want to remind you that if you consider yourself, Peter and I happen not to be Christians, we're not Christians, but if you consider yourself somebody who is a practitioner of Christianity, and you're not discussing these things, and you're not championing social justice in some shape, form, or fashion, and you're not championing an end to the loss of innocent life, the loss of civilians, the by way of whether it's a mass one gunman here, as well as by way of a very large, destructive mass murderer known as United States foreign policy. If you're not equally championing those, then, you know, you really need to. I would say you really need to reassess, like, what religion you're following. And you might take a page from from that song "Losing My Religion." You might need to lose that religion because it's not doing you any good. It's moving you very far away from your humanity. It's making you a very ugly, ugly human being if you're not incensed and in sorrow about also the loss of life of people in those places that we mentioned before, as well as people that are of color in places like Chicago and Cleveland, Ohio, and so many other places. You need to reassess that, and we would hope that you think about these things throughout the so-called holiday season, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, and carry that into the new year. Think about those things. So, Peter, I want to play this. And I think, Peter, this is very, very a good way to end the show. And, I want to get your last comments regarding this, Peter, because, you know, I have no qualms about the amount of time that we're putting on this, because this is really a matter of life or death. And if people can get mobilized and galvanized because, you know, by way of conversation, which that's what conversation should do. It should galvanize and energize people to become more active in areas that they may have been in the past, or in areas that they haven't been in the past, and to try to forge a way for a better society, a more humane society. So you can never have enough strong conversation that's geared towards trying to save lives. So, Peter, here we go, and simply known as Mass Murder Nation.
As a native-born American, I grew up watching cowboy and Indian shoot-em-ups, in which the highlight of the movie was when the white guys in the circled wagon train shot the Indians off their horses until all the red men were dead and very silent. Indians didn't do a lot of screaming in pain when they got shot. They just expired. Same thing with buck-tooth Japanese, line after line of them charging into U.S. machine guns, falling instantly silent and dead. It was somehow quite clean, almost antiseptic, these cinematic rituals of death, all staged for the broadest popular consumption to demonstrate the inevitability and cosmic justice of ultimate white victory over the darker races. This was mother's milk to the white American nation, which is why Richard Pryor and kids like me rooted for the Indians. Mass murder is at the core of the American national religion, which is a celebration of a genocidal march across a continent filled with other doomed human beings. America's contribution to European culture was to invite all the nations of Europe to come to these shores and become fellow white citizens, whose status was defined by the enforced inferiority of blacks and the remnants of the Indians. Ritual burnings of blacks were organized as great public festivals attended by thousands, staged in order to affirm whites' collective right to commit murder. This monopoly on violence was what made them white Americans. U.S. foreign policy reflects the nation's origins and ghastly evolution into a globe-strutting mob that empowers itself to kill at will. 1 million dead Filipinos at the turn of the 20th century, aerial bombing of Haitian villages less than a generation later, the totally unwarranted nuclear annihilation of 2 cities at the end of World War II, 2 million dead Koreans shortly thereafter, 3 million dead Vietnamese in the next decade, followed by hundreds of thousands of Central Americans dead by U.S. proxy, then 1 million Iraqis, and since 1996, 6 million Congolese, all and many, many more slaughtered in the name of U.S. civilizational superiority, the ghastly opiate of the white American masses. What kind of human beings does such a culture produce? To paraphrase the Bible, by their massacres you shall know them. The modern mass American murder is overwhelmingly a white phenomenon. Yet few whites ask the question, what's wrong with white America? It seems that white America lacks the capacity for self-examination. It cannot grasp the simple truth that a culture that celebrates the annihilation of whole peoples casually and without guilt or introspection is devoid of human values at its very core. In the end, it turns against itself. That is the simple lesson of Newtown and Columbine and Aurora. The same cultural deformity creates a huge market for games like the very popular Assassin's Creed, whose latest version integrates individual and group murder with events of the American Revolutionary War. American kids can simulate mass murder all day long and feel patriotic and smart while doing it. Assassin's Creed features an interracial cast of killers, possibly in deference to the brown guy in the White House who owns the ultimate kill list. It's the modern equivalent of the cowboy and Indian movies of my youth, the same sickness. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Peter, last words.
What did Glenn call it? He called it a sickness. And until we begin to deconstruct the sickness that is Americanism, the way we started the show by deconstructing Christmas and then moving forward to deconstruct Christianity, we have to do the same thing and deconstruct Americanism. We have to look ourselves in the mirror. White America has to realize that it's sick, and we all have to work to change this thing that's called America. We've got to do it different to save ourselves and to save humanity. That's the bottom line, Solomon. And we can start this Christmas by challenging the narrative, by not participating in the myths and the lies, and then expanding that and moving outward by applying that same critical worldview to be what it means to be America, what America really is about. Because Glenn said it better than I could say it. America is a sickness. Americanism is a sickness. And we've got to cure ourselves. We've got to work to cure ourselves.
Right on. Got nothing to add, Peter. I just want to say it's been a pleasure to host yet another program with you, and I look forward to working with you in the next couple of weeks to put together this radio forum that we're going to have, and we're going to open it up to the people to call in. And so, folks, be on lookout for that. Continue to check Your World News for updates on that. And also, please also make sure that you check yourworldnews.org. That's yourworldnews.org. For articles and insight and news information, regarding a range of things. We need your support as a community, which means that we need you to tune into our shows and to visit our website as frequently as possible. You know, that information is for you. It's free, as it should be. All information and critical information should be free and open to the public, and it is. But we need your support, and pass the link to the radio shows as well as to the website on to all your friends, family, and networks. And because we need to embrace the notion of each one teach 9 or 10 or 11 or 12 or 15. Each one teach as many as you possibly can. You can't teach without information. And so and that's what we try to do at Your World News. We try to teach and we try to learn from you, the community, because education and knowledge should be a sharing of ideas and information. And so we look forward to learning from our listeners as much as our listeners tune in to hear the critical analysis and the information provided by our guests and hopefully by ourselves, Peter, myself, Tim Badoff Lynch, and Nisa Williams, and all the people that are affiliated with Your World News. So thanks a lot, Peter. I appreciate it, and look forward to it. And just lastly, Peter, what might you be doing on Wednesday, or not Wednesday, Tuesday?
Well, actually, Solomon, I'm going to be having my solstice observation today, since today is the solstice. So I'll be doing some things this evening to just observe the solstice and usher in a new season, a winter season. And then on Tuesday, actually, I'll be celebrating Kwanzaa in my household, and we're going to start our Kwanzaa celebration on Tuesday, a day earlier, because we don't celebrate Christmas. So we'll be starting that a day earlier. So we'll have a little festivity here in the household, but no Christmas trees, no Santa Claus, none of that stuff. But we'll be having a kind of an Afrocentric focused, cultural related type of observation starting on Tuesday and then carrying through the next several days. So that's what we'll be doing.
All right, right on. All right, Peter. For Peter Fowler, I'm Solomon Kamajan, and this is Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. And to take us out with, I think, a song that's apropos for the times, it will be KRS-One. The song is simply known as Why Is That?
Hit it.
Stronger than war, to conquer it and its law. Mental pictures,